I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. I always look where Philadelphia is on an author's book tour. If we're near the top, I figure the writer will be fresh and enthusiastic and ready to answer my questions. If we're among the last stops, I just know they'll be counting the days, even the hours, when they get to go home and get back to their regular life. And they've probably been asked every possible question about their book and about their life. So timing matters in book tours, and apparently in surgery, in the law, at school, on American Idol, and in life. Our guest Daniel Pink says it's time to take time as seriously as we take who, what, where, and how. His new book is titled When, and it's based on the latest research about how our circadian rhythms affect our mood and our cognition, creativity, concentration, and well-being. Daniel Pink is a writer and joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you back with us on the show.
Marty, great to be here.
You know, you were supposed to be on the show about a month ago or so. Then the Eagles went ahead and won the Super Bowl.
I've heard that.
This city went crazy and your book tour was canceled and now you're back. I raise that because I feel in many ways time and timing is so often out of our control.
Oh. There's no question about that. A lot of what we think, when we think of the word time, and we sometimes think of it as chance, as fortune, as circumstance, and it is. That's true of a wide array of our lives. It's something we don't like to think about very much. There's an enormous amount of just randomness and luck in what it is to be a human being on this planet. However, there's another dimension of time, which is where we can be much more intentional. And that's some of the decisions we make about when to do things.
Did you write this book because you had a problem with time and timing?
I did.
Your own personal problems?
I did. Well, I have all kinds of personal problems, but one the temporal.
We'll just deal with this one.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, I did. I found myself making all kinds of those decisions in my own life. When should I do this kind of work? When should I start a project? When should I abandon a project? Even things like when should I exercise during the day? And I was making those decisions in a very sloppy way. I wanted to make them in a more intelligent way. So I looked around for guidance. And to my surprise, I was really surprised by this. It didn't exist.
Hmm.
So then the frustration turned to curiosity. I said, okay, come on. Someone's had to be looking at this. And that took me down this rabbit hole of research for a couple of years, where it turns out there's an enormous amount of research on this question. The challenge is that it's splattered across literally dozens of different disciplines in the social sciences and the physical sciences. There's a whole field called chronobiology. And what's interesting is that all these scholars in these disparate fields are asking very similar questions. What's the effect of time of day on how we feel and what we do? How do beginnings affect us? How do midpoints affect us? How do endings affect us? And what I tried to do is just harvest that research and try to give us some evidence-based ways to make better, smarter decisions about when to do things.
And I want to pick up on all of that. I have to say, though, that radio has taught me something about time and timing. In part, there's a clock over your head. There are very specific points where I have to end a discussion, get back in a discussion. There are the interviews are an hour. Sometimes they feel like five. Sometimes they feel like 5 minutes. And the time is very subjective and feels very flexible.
Right. Well, that's our perception of time. I mean, when you get into the issue of time itself, it is heady, to put it mildly.
Right.
Time is an incredibly abstract concept. And, you know, you have both physicists and philosophers, people coming from very different ends of the academic spectrum, trying to make sense of it. And in our own lives, we try to make sense of it too. One way we try to make sense of time is by corralling it. And so one of the things that I discovered in doing this research, Marty, is that these things that I thought were sort of natural units of time, a second, an hour,
right,
totally made up. I mean, they're just things that human beings have done to in response to that sort of sense. Oh my gosh, time is so elusive. It's so abstract. I got to put some fences around it. So minutes and hours and seconds and weeks, those are things that human beings have created. There's nothing natural about them. There is something natural about the day. And so that ends up playing a big role in how we accommodate ourselves to time.
In fact, there is a kind of a rhythm to the day. And you also ask us all as readers, are you a lark? Are you an owl? Or are you a third bird? I am a lark. I'm an early morning person. That's just sort of the way I'm built.
Yeah.
How about you?
I am in the middle, but larky. I'm not a lark, but larky. I come out toward the lark side of the spectrum, but not a full-fledged lark. And this is actually really important because that's the first – that's what's called a chronotype. And it's the first step in figuring out at the unit of a day what's the right time to do certain things. And so your first task is, you know, figure out are you a lark or are you an owl. There's a very simple back-of-the-envelope way that people can do it. You basically take the time – I mean, I can – you know, so for instance, for me – on a free day, a day right. I don't have to get up to an alarm clock, right. I typically will go to sleep at about midnight and wake up at about 8.
Wow.
Okay? So that gives me a midpoint of sleep of 4 a.m. And that's what you try to figure out. What's your midpoint of sleep on days when you don't have to get up to an alarm clock? And if it's 3:30 or before, you're a lark. If it's 5:30 or after, you're an owl. And if it's in the middle, you are a third bird. So I'm, you know, a third bird leaning toward larkiness. And what a massive researchers have found is that about 80% of us, that is 20% of us are 20% of us are owls. About 80% of us move through the day in the following order: a peak, a trough, a recovery. Our mood goes up, our mood dips significantly, and our mood recovers. That has an effect on performance too. Owls, very complicated people, these people who are evening-oriented.
The late-night people.
The late-night people. The world is – I think the corporate world is designed to crush their spirits actually. It's hard being an owl. They tend to move in the reverse direction. Recovery, trough, peak. And what the research shows is that if we understand these three broad stages of the day, we can do certain work at certain kinds of the day and mm-hmm. do better at it.
Well, in fact, you have a couple of charts here. People feel increasingly happy throughout the morning, less happy in the afternoon. That's that trough. And then happier again in the evening. That's most people.
That's most people because 80% of us are either in the middle or larks. Owls are, again, as I said, far more complicated.
This is based in part on some research of 500 million tweets.
Oh, well, that's a wonderful piece of research.
and it was 500 million, I should say. Yes.
I mean, this is – the way that scholars are doing research these days is quite fascinating because there's so much data out there and the tools for analyzing the data are so great. So this is a study done by two researchers at Cornell, and they used a program that think of it as a very powerful piece of software that can analyze text. In all kinds of dimensions. And in this particular case, they were looking at the emotional level of words that were used. So you can use novels, you can use newspaper articles, you can use just massive amounts of text, throw it into this program and analyze it. Well, they decided to use, as you said, this body of text of 500 million tweets, half a billion tweets from 2.5 million people.
The thought of going through half a billion tweets is just almost nauseating.
Well, imagine doing it, but that's why we have software, because software doesn't get nauseated, all right, like you and I do, all right? So, but imagine – seriously, that's a great point, because think about an individual researcher, you or me or an individual journalist going through half a billion tweets.
Yeah.
I mean, you would just pack it up at probably after 1,000. But software doesn't get tired. Software doesn't get bored. Software doesn't get sickened by the harshness of people's words. So – they look at the emotional level of the words. Is it positive sentiment or negative sentiment? And then they plot it out against time of day. And what they found was this predictable pattern in mood. Rising mood in the morning, declining mood in the early afternoon to mid-afternoon, and then recovering mood later in the day. And over and over and over again, no matter the methodology, that's what scholars are finding about a pattern of mood over the course of the day.
Which, if you took that, you'd say, well, then I'm going to make all my important decisions in the morning. I'm going to have all my surgery scheduled in the morning. I hope that the judge will render my verdict in the morning as well. Should that be our takeaway?
No. Although it's part of the takeaway. Here's what we know. All right. During that peak period, again, which for most of us is the morning, for owls is later in the day, we are very high on vigilance. That's the word that comes out in all of these pieces of research. We're very vigilant. What does that mean? Vigilance means you're able to bat away distractions. That makes it this peak period the ideal time for analytic work that requires heads down, focus, attention, energy, writing a report, analyzing data, doing those kinds of things. So we should be doing our analytic work then. During the trough, we'll talk about the trough for a moment. That's a pretty bad time, as you alluded to.
And this is mid-afternoon, right?
This is basically – early to mid-afternoon. there's some bad stuff that happens then. I mean, if you look at – you mentioned surgery. Seriously, I would not let anybody in my family willingly go into a hospital, have surgery, or go to an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon. The data here are overwhelming. Anesthesia errors are 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. Doctors performing colonoscopies find half as many polyps in afternoon exams versus morning exams for the same population. Mm-hmm. Hand washing in hospitals declines and this is research that hand washing research was done partly by Katie Milkman, who's here at the University of Pennsylvania. Massive decline in hand washing in hospitals in the afternoon. And so even if you look at something like traffic accidents, obviously you're going to be more traffic accidents when there are more cars on the road. But once you control for that, the most dangerous time to be on the road is 4 to 6 a.m., not surprisingly.
Right. Early morning.
Early morning. It's dark outside. You know, what are people doing out then? The second most dangerous time is 2 to 4 p.m.
Hmm.
You look even at things like standardized test scores for students. Big drop during that.
Well, isn't that an argument? Then let's at least shove all these more sort of vigilant requiring
tasks yes,
to
absolutely.
The morning.
You shove the vigilance, the tasks that require vigilance to the morning, and then do a lot of our administrative work, stuff that doesn't require a heavy cognitive load in that trough period. But I don't want to suggest that everything that's important belongs in that peak period, because let's go to the recovery stage. The recovery stage is actually really interesting. What we have is we have rising mood. Okay, so our mood is going back up. However, we're less vigilant. Now, that seems like a bug, but it's really a feature in some cases. So elevated mood and lack of lower vigilance makes it a good time for certain creative things, for brainstorming ideas, for iterating things like that. And so
there are fewer inhibitions in a way?
Exactly. That's precisely what it is. It's all about inhibitions. And so if you think about brainstorming, if people feel inhibited, they're not going to be as good brainstormers. If you have someone – and we've been in these meetings before. Hey, let's brainstorm. And then there's some guy sitting there. That's a terrible idea. That's a terrible idea. He's hyper-vigilant and sort of annoying, batting away those ideas. And anyway, what this distills to is a set of design principles that I think are actually pretty powerful. We should be doing our analytic work during the peak, our administrative work during the trough, and our insight and creative work during the recovery. And what the research is telling us is that time of day, just time of day alone, explains about 20% of the variance in how people perform on tasks requiring brain power. So that's a big deal.
Let me take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And that is Daniel Pink. We're talking about his new book. It's titled When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He's the author of a number of books, including Drive to Sell is Human, and he has been a guest on Radio Times in the past talking about some of his ideas. And we want to hear from you. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Daniel Pink about the ebb and flow of our circadian rhythms, about mood and performance and the peaks, the troughs, and the recoveries in our daily lives. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. As you were talking about this trough, which tends to be for most people in the afternoon, is that because they've had a big lunch? I mean, it is when cultures have put in that siesta. Is that in part to deal with what seems to be happening naturally to the human body?
You know, it's hard to disentangle that. Actually, it's not entirely about eating. That ebb in the early afternoon seems to be prevalent, irrespective of food, and it's not clear exactly why that is. I actually think there's the strongest explanation I've seen is an evolutionary explanation, which is basically that when we were evolving, we're out in the savannah. There's no air conditioning, there's no buildings or anything like that, and so people who stayed out at that time of day in the broiling midday sun died. and didn't pass their genes on. And people who would ever had this adaptation, this propensity to get a little sleepy and went and took a little snooze under the tree at that time, they stayed alive and passed their genes into the next generation. That's the most plausible explanation I can see for this. But what I think happens is that people feel when people experience it themselves, they feel sort of a sense of personal responsibility for it. Oh man, here we go. I'm so lazy. I can't stay awake. And it's essentially true for everybody. It's because you are a biological creature. And one of the things we have to get our minds around is, and no one ever tells you this in school, no one ever tells you this at work, our cognitive abilities don't stay the same throughout the day. Period. Full stop. They change. And that's just part of what it is to be human. That's not a moral weakness or a personal flaw. It's just the way human beings are wired. And the danger is ignoring that or not doing anything about it.
Well, you make a case, and I guess scientists are making a case for things like a short nap during the day or taking a break, certain kinds of breaks during the day that can help restore some of those intellectual juices.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, well, but the breaks is interesting. In my view, the science of breaks is where the science of sleep was not that long ago. You know, 15 years ago, people who pulled all-nighters were heroes. Now, what's happened is that we know the science of sleep has deepened, but we've had actually a public discussion about the science, and it's really changed at least some of our behavior. We no longer deify that guy who goes without sleep. We think he's an idiot. And so I think the same thing is happening with breaks. What we're learning is that we human beings should be taking more breaks. And as you say, Marty, we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. And what we have to do is get past this very kind of puritanical notion that it's the way to get stuff done is to power through all the time, and also that it's somehow morally virtuous to power through. What we know, and I'm a sinner here. I have changed my. I'm saved now, but I was a sinner.
You saw the error of your ways.
The science showed me the error of my ways. I used to believe that that amateurs were the ones who took breaks and professionals didn't take breaks. And it's exactly the opposite. Professionals take breaks. We see this in sports. We see this in music. And so what we have to be is intentional about our breaks. And we know a lot. Again, if you think about these as design principles, we know the sorts of breaks that are most restorative.
Well, one of the things that you write about in here, and this is, again, based on research, which is that judges end up being more lenient after taking a break. Explain how that works.
This is a remarkable study, and there is a lot of – there's some very kind of alarming research on jury and judicial decision-making and how it changes over the course of a day. But this is a reasonably famous study out of Israel about prisoners going for parole before parole judges. And what they found is that early in the day, prisoners had a decent chance of parole, and then it just dropped.
As the day progressed.
As the morning progressed, it dropped. And then you give a judge a break, and she comes back from the break, and suddenly your probability of getting parole goes a lot higher. I mean, these judges made dramatically different decisions before a break and after a break.
But does that say they were more humane because of the break, or they were somehow more lenient?
Yeah.
How does that fit in?
Yeah, I think I'm
– maybe less cranky?
Yeah, I actually want to strip away this is my own view of it. Strip away sort of the moral side of it, the lenient side of it, and basically think of it in a slightly more sterile way, I guess. Which is this: when human beings make decisions, we come to a decision, especially when someone's asking us something. We come to that encounter with a default decision. And the default decision in most cases is no. So you go and you ask your boss for a raise, she's going to say no. You go or you're selling something, you go to a prospect, you want to buy my widget, the default answer is no. And so what I think what seems to be happening is that after a break, we're more restored, we're willing at least to consider the possibilities of overcoming that default decision. And the default decision in parole is no. I mean, there's no – a judge who doesn't grant parole – is not taking any risk.
Right.
A judge who does grant parole could be taking a risk. And so the default decision is not to grant parole. After a break, we're more likely to challenge a default. Early in the day and after a break, people seem to be more likely to challenge a default, which I think yields some interesting guidance for when do you pitch your product? When do you ask your boss for a raise? When do you ask somebody out for a date? When do you ask your parents to borrow the car?
Let me read some comments here. We've got some calls as well. One from Nell. Can people's rhythms change over time? Thinking of children, I have four. They're quite different in energy peak times, but they're still young. Might this change over time or change into adulthood? You have a lot in here about teenagers. I'm not sure if Nell's kids are teenagers yet or not, but do rhythms change with age?
Dramatically. What you find is that I don't know how old Nell's kids are, obviously, but little kids, larks.
Larks.
Big-time larks, as any parent of little kids knows. They get up early, start running around like
up
crazy people right away. Then, and this is, I think, the most important change in our chronobiology. This is the most important change in our chronobiology in our lifetimes. Around the age of 14, around the age of puberty, people experience a massive shift toward lateness, sometimes 2-3 hours. A period of peak owliness, really, that extends from about age 14 to about age, mid-20s. And then, in general, people will return to greater larkiness over time. Men tend to be a little owlier than women. Women return to larkiness a little bit more swiftly than men. Recognizing there's still 1 in 5 of us are just hardcore owls regardless. But that period, that teen period, 14 to 24, call it, there is a marked change in our chronobiology.
And it looks like the schools that have made that shift, so they're opening instead of 7:15 in the morning, more like 8:30 or maybe even 9, they get results.
Yes, they do.
Students perform better.
Yes, they do. The American Academy of Pediatrics, about 4 years ago, issued a policy statement saying that imploring schools around America, do not start school for teenagers before 8:30 in the morning. It is contraindicated by everything that we know. The research on school start times, to me, is not a close call. And what's interesting, as you mentioned, Marty, is that schools that have pushed back start times for teenagers, and we're not talking about going crazy here. We're talking about starting school at 9:15, not starting it at 1 in the afternoon, have seen lower dropout rates, higher test scores, less obesity, less depression, fewer car crashes. And when you think about it, it's a little bit sterile to think about the American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement. Instead, picture your kids' pediatricians and all pediatricians, linking arms and marching down Market Street with signs. I mean, that's what they're saying. And it's all because of that question that Nell asked, is that our bodies and our chronobiology change over time.
Let me get, looks like Zaleed from Roxborough to join our conversation. A related question. Zaleed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, I noticed that since I retired, my whole pattern of life is different. I used to have to get up at 5:00 in the morning and get the bus at 6:30. And when I was working in another job, it was 3 to 11:30. But now that I'm home all the time, I just go to bed a little later in the evening, and then I just don't hurry to get up in the morning. And then I've got a lot of energy. Then I sort of slow right down again, and then I perk up.
Well, that's
but it's quite different than when I was working.
Oh, indeed. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And obviously work kind of builds in a schedule,
sure,
whether it fits our chronobiology or not.
Absolutely. I mean, Zaleed sounds like she is maybe sort of a moderate third bird, but she was working a lark schedule.
Right.
And so we can do that. I mean, that's why we have alarm clocks. I mean, we can physically wake up at 5:00 in the morning, even if we're not naturally going to wake up in that. But it takes a toll. And you remove some of those external requirements, and people will essentially adapt to the rhythm that is right for them. What would be nicer, and there's some good evidence that this is a boon to productivity, is that we accommodate the schedules to fit the person rather than change the person to fit the schedule.
Yeah, in a perfect world. Perhaps.
In a perfect world, yeah. We can't do that obviously for every kind of profession, but I think that there are a lot of jobs where if you give people a little bit more autonomy and sovereignty over when they do the work, you're going to see better results.
A tweet from Jean. She says, I taught for 38 years. The first 37 went by in a flash. The last 6 months, forever. That's an interesting observation about endings.
Mm.
And if we're talking about timing and endings, does that make sense to you, what Jean just tweeted?
I think so, yeah. When we get off, when we move beyond the unit of a day and think about our lives as a series of episodes, episodes have beginnings, middles, and ends. And endings have a bit – endings are a fascinating area. It's actually one of my favorite areas of research about how endings affect our behavior. And I think what what she might be experiencing there is one of the effects of endings, which is that endings are often a trigger for a search for meaning. And so if you have if you've been doing something, this very tough job for 37 years, and suddenly you see it coming to an end, you start pondering, okay, what's it been about? What's going on here? And you see this manifest itself in some really interesting behavior. One of my favorite pieces of research from Adam Alter and Hal Hirschfield is about marathon runners. People who – the age at which people are most likely to run their first marathon is 29. 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 28-year-olds and 30-year-olds. 39 is a common age to run a first marathon. 49-year-olds, three times more likely to run a first marathon than 50-year-olds. And so what you see is when people see the end of something, they say, oh, wait, what's going on here? I have to do something meaningful. And that could be what she's experiencing with this perception that time is slowing down as she considers her life, understands what this devotion, you know, it's incredible, 37 years of teaching, what it's been all about.
You also quote some research, and I'm quoting here, as people age, they edit their friends. I mean, sometimes friends die.
That's true.
I'm at the age where friends of mine are dying. That there's that reality. But there's also, I agree with you, I think there's a point in which you say, how do I want to live what's left of my life, even though I don't know how it's all going to end?
This is some really remarkable research. I think it's profound and meaningful research from Laura Carstensen at Stanford, where she looked at the size of people's friend networks over time. And so when we're younger, middle age, our friend networks are pretty expansive. But then after around age 60, you know, around that time, there's a huge drop off in our friend network. And so it seems superficially like a sad story. Your people are getting lonelier, their friends are dying. But when Carstensen went and actually peeled back the layers of that, what she did is she said, take your friends and put them into three categories, inner circle, middle circle, and outer circle. And what she found is that all the drop-off was in the middle circle and the outer circle. The inner circle stayed the same. And in fact, in some cases, it got a little bit bigger because people are saying, whoa, I'm not going to be here forever. I don't want to spend
I
don't want to spend my time with, you know, with people who I don't really like. I want to spend time with people who are the most meaningful to me. And so they edit down their friendship networks to the core. And this is sort of one of the paradoxes is that you know, older people are often, not always, but older people as a general population are often happier than younger people. And I think that's a reason for it. They've edited down to things that are meaningful.
Let me see what Greg from Philadelphia has to say. And Greg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I was wondering, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Greg.
Oh, great. I was wondering, I am most definitely an owl. I always have been as far as I can remember. But I work in a very, I was going to say 9 to 5, but I don't mean that. More like 7:30 to 5 type of corporate environment. And the vast majority of my colleagues are very clearly larks, or at least are pretending to be. And I wondered if you had any kind of thoughts or any suggestions on how to balance that a little bit more, particularly with, you know, scheduling meetings and kind of the perception that I don't necessarily get going, so to speak, until maybe 9:30 or 10 in the morning, something like that, when I do my best work.
Sure.
As opposed to a lot of other folks scheduling things at 8 o'clock in the morning, that I am basically worthless.
Well, you're calling into a radio show, Greg, so you're not entirely worthless, and I appreciate that.
It was a very astute question at 10:35 a.m., so
we're
clearly
proud of you.
At your cognitive peak right now, Greg.
So what do you think, Dave?
Well, I think it's a great, great question. It's a common issue. So let me offer a few things here. Number one, advice to Greg. I wonder whether there's any way to make your boss to make any kind of accommodation for your schedule, even on the margins. Maybe it's you work 8:30 to 6:30 rather than 7:30 to 5. That's sometimes hard, and I don't want to overstate that, but it's possible to do that. Maybe it's also possible there's an idea that you know, 20 years ago, we used to have these things called casual Fridays where people didn't have to dress up at work. And so, you know, why not have maybe a chronotype Friday where people can come in based on their chronotype or something like that? So work the margins of that. I think beyond that, though, let's say, Greg, you do have to go to an 8 o'clock meeting about something that is, you know, analytical, and you can't get out of it, which is often the truth of a lot of our jobs. What I would suggest for the owls like Greg would be to do the following, is that the day before when you're in your peak, later in the day in the early evening, think about that meeting and just make a small checklist. What do you need to say at that meeting? What do you need to get done at that meeting? What questions do you need to ask at that meeting? What do you need to accomplish at that meeting? And literally just make a small checklist. Bring it with you to that 8 o'clock meeting so you don't have to draw on your fuzzy head at that moment. The other thing is, back to breaks, is if it's an important meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning, go take a walk outside before that meeting. That'll restore a little bit of your energy, because what we know about the most effective breaks is that they're moving, they're outside, they're detached, they're often social. So take a walk outside before you do that.
And take a walk with a colleague also?
Yeah, taking a walk. What we know about breaks is that, believe it or not, social breaks are more restorative than solo breaks, even for introverts. I found that really surprising. There's something about taking a break with somebody else that seems to restore our mental acuity and our energy a little bit more. We also know that moving is better than being sedentary. I think that's fairly obvious. A lot of good research on the value of being outside and in nature, probably not on a day like this, but in general, being outside. And then this idea of detachment is hugely important. So leave your phone behind and don't talk about work. And those kinds of short breaks can be really, really restorative. But I think the other thing that Greg – the point that Greg makes, which I think is urgent in organizations, he mentioned meetings. When we schedule meetings in organizations, the only criterion that we use is availability. We don't think, oh, what kind of meeting is this? Are we brainstorming? Is it an analytic meeting? Are we meeting about our travel voucher policy? We don't say, hey, Greg's kind of owly and Marty's a lark. Should they both be in the same meeting? We just say who's available and put it on Outlook, and we don't think of it as a strategic decision. And it is a strategic decision. That's the thing that's so frustrating about it.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Greg, thanks for calling. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Lots of comments coming in. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with Daniel Pink about his book, When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. I'm talking with Daniel Pink. He's the author of a number of books, including Drive to Sell as Human and his new one called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Let me read an email from Diane. She says, please ask your guest if he was informed at all by Ayurveda, the science of yoga, which is all about nature and our daily cycles. Life cycles. You're nodding your head, yes.
Well, it's interesting because it wasn't informed by that, but I think that those there are several things that are not necessarily all rooted in science that seem to actually be consonant with the science. And so if you look at even the Quran has a lot of writing about sleep, and it's very similar in its spirit to modern sleep science. The same thing is true with certain kinds of yoga practices, even sort of the cultural practice of a siesta, which is basically we're going to take a break during this dip to restore, is consonant with what a lot of the science says. Mm-hmm. So I think what's interesting about that is that some of these practices, again, and with it, these practices that are around the world that aren't rooted in a particular faith, that aren't rooted in a particular culture, seem to be having this intuitive sense that what scientists are telling us is that in a day, we do not remain the same during a day. Our brain changes, our emotion changes, and simply ignoring that is something that's dangerous.
And to reinforce that, this is a section about accomplished violinists. Practice a lot in the morning, take off in the afternoon, and practice a little more in the evening. So Right. We should borrow from, you know, the violinists of the world.
But, I mean, if you look at – that's the work of Anders Ericsson at Florida State, who found that the elite violinists were actually taking more breaks than the non-elite violinists. But what they were doing is they were very intentional about their breaks. They weren't thinking of breaks as, okay, I'm tired, now I'm going to take a break. Right. They're basically saying there's certain times when I take a break, I'm intentional about my breaks. And that's one of the things that I've done myself in response to this, is that every afternoon when I work in the garage behind my house in Washington, D.C., I make a break list. I write down two breaks I'm going to take every day, which is a big change for me.
I mean, write them into your schedule.
Write them on, right, exactly.
So I'm going to get up from my desk whatever.
I say literally 1 p.m. Walk around the block, and I'll go take, you know, walk around my neighborhood for 10 minutes. Or my wife also works at home, and so I'll say 4 o'clock post office. There's a post office 7 minutes away, and we'll go, you know, walk outside, go to the post office, drop something out. I mean, it doesn't sound super exciting.
No.
But let me defend it because it's moving. It's outside, it's with somebody I like, and it's detached. And even those – so we don't have to go back to a 3.5-hour siesta every afternoon. But we need to have – be intentional about our breaks. And one way to be intentional is to schedule it.
You also say there was something else you learned when you were, I guess, working with someone and you had to give them either – or I guess both good news and bad news. And you used to start with the good news and then hit them with the bad news. And you're saying really the reverse is what we're supposed to do.
Yep. One of the many things I was doing wrong, although there was an argument for it. I mean, you know, like it's uncomfortable giving bad news, so you want to ease into it. You don't want – I always thought people would shut down if I hit them with the bad news first. You want to have a cushion before hitting them with the hammer. But what this research shows is that when people are on the receiving end of good news and bad news, 4 out of 5 people want the bad news first. Uh-huh. They want the bad news first and then the good news. And this is another feature of endings, which is given a choice, human beings prefer endings that elevate. We prefer rising sequences at the end to declining sequences at the end. So this is another area where I've changed my own behavior. I now give the bad news first, follow it with the good.
And because one would think kind of intuitively that the bad news, people would shut down, they'd get defensive, argumentative. I mean, there are all sorts of ways that you can receive bad news.
Right.
But you're saying when all is said and done, that's a more effective way of delivering
good
feedback?
It's a more effective way of delivering good news and bad news because of our preference for endings with rising sequences. I mean, the thing is, if you have bad news, even if you give bad news last, people don't like bad news.
No, of course
and
not.
And so, you know, and so you risk like ending the conversation with a shutdown rather than beginning with a little resistance and then saying, but there's good news here too. And so people feel at the end that they're elevated.
And they get that little lift.
How things end is so profoundly important that the way we remember experiences, the way we remember everything from family vacations to restaurant meals to how we assess the morality of entire lives hinges disproportionately on how those kinds of events and experiences end. And it's another area in our lives where we can be much more intentional. If we're intentional about how things end in an elevated way, we're going to feel better. We're going to do better.
How should we end our vacations then?
What we should do is we should end our vacations with something that is memorable, that's sort of a peak, memorable and exciting. Don't put all of it at the beginning.
Don't be stuck at the airport for 8 hours.
Right, if you can avoid that. But actually intentionally plan your last day of vacation to be something big. And there's some research by a number of Elizabeth Dunn at University of British Columbia has done some research on this as well. And it's also true for all your listeners out there in consumer-facing businesses. You can see this anecdotally on Yelp. If you look at Yelp reviews of restaurants, a disproportionate number of the reviews talk about how did the meal end.
Right.
And that's how people remember things. There's research on – I find it fascinating where you give people a character who was a jerk for 29 years and was good for 1 year. It happened to be his final year. And then the reverse scenario where a guy was – great for 29 years and a jerk for his final year, they evaluate the morality of those lives roughly equal. because
even though mathematically that doesn't add up,
it makes
right?
no sense. But it's endings shape our behavior and our memories in profound ways.
I do want to talk about beginnings, but let me get Laura from, looks like Princeton, to join our conversation. And Laura, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Well, years ago, I studied with a teacher from India. And he taught a practice of waking up 1 hour before the sunrise and doing certain practices and then sitting in meditation throughout the sunrise itself. And so our days were synchronized with the rhythms, the natural rhythms of the earth and the sun. And I have to say that just experientially, I'm not a natural lark. But it was an incredible – the benefits were incredible, and I felt better doing that than I probably have at any other time in my life. So I wonder if he's actually has studied some of these synchronicities with in relation to Earth and its natural rhythms, rather than just people separate from our natural world.
Fair enough, Laura. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but that's an interesting
story. There's a whole principle in basically how human beings wake up and go to sleep, how they navigate the world. A principle called entrainment. That is, we have our natural rhythms, biological rhythms. Mm-hmm. That if we put us in a cave, without light, we're still gonna do that. But we entrain to other kinds of external forces, including sunlight, darkness, and even to some extent schedule. So what might be going on there is some kind of entrainment. My hunch is that it's just, meditation is one of those things that's very, very good for us. And so it just could be that the meditation was driving a lot of that. The caller is right about this sort of broader synchronicity. If you look at synchronized activities that human beings do, they're incredibly good for us. So the research, for instance, on choral singing.
That was interesting.
The benefits of choral singing are mind-boggling. I mean, choral singing is basically up there with meditation and physical exercise in its value for you. It's a prophylactic against depression. It's a mood booster. It has a physiological effect.
Is it the singing, do you think?
Because they've tested this. It's when people sing alone, there you don't get this effect. It's singing together that really has this effect. Even things literally at the physiological level, that people's immune response rises after singing in choirs. It makes people more likely to do good deeds. You see this with kids doing synchronized activities. Kids doing synchronized activities afterwards exhibit more helping behavior, more likely to play with kids who don't look like them. You look at rowers rowing separately, rowers rowing in a team. Even if the physical exertion is the same, rowers in a team feel less pain. There's something just incredible and inhuman about synchronizing with other people.
Something very tribal in a way.
Yeah.
The good kind of tribal.
I think it's part of what it is to be human. Like, we're not solo actors all the time. We want to be in sync with other people because that's how we accomplish things. That's how we feel good.
Here's a tweet from Christine. What does Daniel have to say about marriage, hardcore owl, and how that affects a marriage, especially one that is in the throes of raising children and jobs, which are lark schedules?
Yeah.
All right. Can you solve this problem?
I try not to do any marital counseling, but what you see here is that's a tough one.
It is.
And I think what you have to do is at the individual and family level is recognize that this person who's staying up late and having a hard time getting up in the morning, it isn't because he's lazy. Mm-hmm. It's because he's an owl. And so we have to be generous and empathetic to people's different kinds of chronotypes. But this is actually in some ways a more chronic problem, because if you look at Till Ronenberg, who's a chronobiologist in Munich, has some really good research on this. If you look at heterosexual couples of the same age often have incompatible sleeping patterns, because men in general are owlier than women and return to larkiness more slowly. So what you often have is men and heterosexual couples, the man is often going to sleep an hour later than the woman. Men who marry younger women actually have much more compatible sleeping patterns. I'm not advocating that either.
Right. Well, maybe the owl can get up in the middle of the night when the child gets up and the lark gets to sleep in.
I think that would be a lovely way of working this out.
Well, let's talk about beginnings. And you make an interesting point here. We know about New Year's resolutions, mm-hmm. and how they are rarely ever successful. But you say there are other ways to think about starting things, that there are many beginnings in our day, in our week, our month, our life that can be a point at which we say, I'm going to do X, Y, or Z.
Sure. Those are what researchers call temporal landmarks. That is, there are certain days. Think about a physical landmark. A physical landmark stands out in physical space. And what does it do? It gets us to slow down, pay attention a little bit more. And there are these temporal landmarks too. And certain kinds of temporal landmarks have this trigger this peculiar form of mental accounting that they're what are called fresh start dates. And this is research that was done at Penn by Katie Milkman, Jason Reese, and Heng Chen Dai, who's now at UCLA. And so what they found is that certain dates, these fresh start dates, trigger this kind of mental accounting where like a business opening up a fresh ledger at the beginning of a quarter, at the beginning of a year, we open up a fresh ledger on ourselves. So it's not only New Year's Day, but we're more likely to start a new exercise regime on the first of the month rather than on the 13th of the month, on a Monday rather than on a Thursday, on the day after our birthday rather than 3 days before our birthday. And so these markers in time, these temporal landmarks, can be ways that we can a little bit more consciously up the chances of behaving a little better.
So that if we screw up on the New Year's resolution, we can
reboot.
We can reboot on the 1st of February.
February 1 or on the day after your birthday or the day after your anniversary or the day of a first day of a new project or something like that.
Let me see what Kathy from looks like New Jersey has to say. And Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I want to share an experience. I don't know if you've ever done any research on how we experience the passage of time differently. And I'll tell you a quick story. It was the end of the summer, and I said to my 10-year-old grandson when I was 75, the summer went so fast, I can't believe it's over. And he said to me, Grammy, it didn't go fast for me. But this was his observation. You must remember that you're older than me, so you don't have as much time left. He said, so it feels like it's going faster for you.
I would say you have a very perceptive grandson there, Kathy.
I was amazed at that quick observation, but I live in a retirement community. I have a great social life, but I do feel that, you know, today is Tuesday. Wow, that past week went fast.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I appreciate calling into Radio Times. We're back at this more
this idea of perception and it changes. I mean, there's you know, if you think about your grandson, for him, or when he was 10, for him a year is 10% of his life. You know, for me, so that's 10% of your life is a long time. For me, 10% of my life is a little over 5 years. Okay, that's a pretty long time. Like if you say, oh, you got to wait 5 years for something, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, yeah, that's a long wait. If you say to me now at age 53, you got to wait a year, I'll say, okay, I can deal. But how we perceive time is really important. How we think about time is really important. And one of the things that comes out in our overall well-being is this idea that what we want to do is we want to actually integrate the past, the present, and the future in how we think about ourselves and how we think about our lives. There's some interesting research on nostalgia. And we tend to say nostalgia sort of has a negative connotation. But nostalgia is very good for us because what it allows us to do is think about the past and how it connects to the present. Something like awe is a very powerful emotion because it gets us to think about the future and time slowing down. And so even the very way we think about time can boost our well-being.
Let me read an email from Bob. Probably no time to respond, but this is interesting. He says, I notice that the days of the week have a minimum, maximum mood to on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst or an angry day. Monday is a 2. Tuesday is a 0 or 1, most angry day for him. Wednesday's a 5. Thursday's an 8. Friday's a 9 to 10. Make sense?
Interesting. So that's like he's ending – he's elevated endings there.
Yeah, and the middle of the week is sort of a tough week, and then as it gets closer to Fridays, these are better and better days.
There's a lot of research on how the midpoint of anything, a week, an experience, a life, can sometimes bring us down, sometimes fire us up.
Well, on that note, Daniel Pink, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Marty, always a pleasure.
Nice to have you with us. And the book is called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. And again, he's the author of a number of other books, including Drive and To Sell Is Human. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. We did a little video before going on the air. We will post that on our Facebook page. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.